Hello and welcome to National Lewis University's Discover You. I am Keith Baltimore. Well, we are celebrating Jewish American Heritage Month here at National Lewis, and we're doing some new things. For the first time here at NLU, we have celebrated Holocaust Remembrance Day, and we're very honored to be able to share this with the community. And in today's episode, we've invited Rabbi Garfinkel, a local Chicago rabbi and friend of NLU, to come and share with us some insights about the Jewish community, the joys of being Jewish, the Holocaust, and some things about Judaism that you may not know or have expected. So tune in. It's going to be a lot of fun because Rabbi Garfinkel, he's quite a guy.
I think it's interesting that the more I dive into the Jewish community, you quickly understand that there is a difference between being culturally Jewish and being religiously Jewish, if I can say put it that way, right?
You are 1,000,000% correct. And so just a funny thing, you know, people come up to me and, you know, whatever, conversations and like, oh my gosh, it's the rabbi, the glasses, the kippah, the beard, you know, it's like, there's like, you know, it's like confession. Like, so we don't do that, but like they're confessing, say, hey, rabbi, I just don't like Judaism. And I'll look at them and I'll be like, me neither. And they're like, rabbi, how can you say that? Like, you're a rabbi. I said, listen, the Judaism you don't like, I also don't like that. I said, let's find out what the real Judaism. I say, you know, look, I have no problem with people like a diet cherry Coke. That's fine. But that's not Coke. You gotta have a Coke classic to appreciate how many deviations a diet cherry Coke is, you know? And so when you go back to the sources, and a lot of people are today, it's a very compelling, authentic, rich approach to life. I like to say, the CEO of the universe designed this amazing machine called the human being, and he gave an instruction manual. And the more you follow the instruction manual, the better the machine works. And that's a very big, and you're very perceptive to see that, Keith, that there are a lot of Jews who are not connected to their Jewish roots, religious Jewish roots, but they're culturally Jewish. They're the bagels, they'll hang out at a Jewish clubs or whatever. And that's really personally my mission, the mission of Project 613, the organization that I founded in, and really hundreds of organizations around the world, to say, hey, time out, it's great. We love the bagels and cream cheese, that's good. But let's dig a little deeper, past the lox, past the salmon, and let's get to the content of what it is to be Jewish. So 100%, and there's a huge range even within all Jewish worlds. The joke goes, two Jews, three opinions. So I'll just speak for myself on this podcast.
That's amazing. So you know that our major audience are college students. And I'm discovering, because I've been working with college students for a long time, that there are just particular things that they would be aware of about a community, just kind of on the surface level. And sometimes it's just things that they hear about in passing. And there's one experience I happen to know a lot about, but I'd like for you to share about, and I'll tell you, it's not on our list here. I was just listening for you and I was like, oh, this would be great. But I'll let you explain this experience that you have for Jewish young people to go back and visit the homeland, if you will, and kind of briefly explain that to college students, what is that like and how that even came about?
Right. So it started just a short little while ago, about 3,800 years ago, with a guy named Abe and his wife, Sarah, Abraham and Sarah. And they got the call from the bullpen. The Almighty gave them the tap on the shoulder. The starting pitchers of the world were getting shelled. It was the bottom of the third inning and it was like 23-0. Okay. And God's like, all right, now don't serve idols. Just Adam and Eve, just don't eat that fruit. Now, come on. You can have anything you want. Just don't eat that one fruit. Oh, come on. You know, they do it. You know, and then generation of Noah come on, guys, just be nice to each other. No, they were so bad they had to be wiped out. And then successive generations. And God's like, listen, I can't keep this up. I already destroyed the world once. I don't want to destroy it again. We need a new approach, right? The definition of insanity is repeating the same approach, expecting a different result. And so God came up with a new concept. He says, I'm going to choose a person who's going to eventually become a people who is going to be held morally responsible for being a beacon of being a standard bearer for the morality of the world. And listen, it's a place of privilege, but it's also a place of responsibility. And that was the call to Abraham. Abraham and Sarah believed in God, and firmly they believed it wasn't an abstract concept, but that God had a relationship with us. There were other people who said God exists, but the unique concept that Abraham and Sarah said is that God is with me. I am with him and he is with me. And that is I think people say the greatest innovation of Abraham was that he believed in one God. That was only part of the story. It's that we can have a relationship, an ongoing day-to-day relationship with God. So he got the call from the bullpen, go to the promised land, and they went. And the moment that Abraham and Sarah stepped foot in the land of Israel, that became home to Abraham's family. That became our home. And 3,800 years later, an unbroken chain of descendants, the Jewish people, and I'm skipping, 3,800 years. When they come back home, and connecting to your first point, Keith, when you talk about many Jews who are not plugged in to this traditional Jewish tradition, they come back home, they come back to Israel, and they like have this experience. It's almost like an awakening. It's like, I believe, but it's something is touched within them of this authentic experience of coming home, and they can't explain it. And what some of my favorite conversations are, someone who comes back from a trip to Israel, say, Rabbi, it was like electric. What was that? I'm like, that's your spiritual electric plug being plugged into the current, into the socket for the first time, buddy. Okay, it's a gift. And so that's what the land of Israel means to the Jewish people. It's our spiritual connection. It's our ancient and yet still eternal homeland. And it's just like that feeling, Keith, as a young person, coming back to your grandparents' house, that warm feeling of being embraced, and that's really what the land of Israel means to the Jewish people.
So there is this experience, this opportunity for young people of a certain age to go back to Israel and to experience it, right?
Right. So basically like this, what happened was, and I know we're all over the place, but I'll just tell you how it is. So in 1990, the Jewish community in America had a cold water wake up. They realized that they were not perpetuating their own people. Not only in birth statistics of a 2.0 replacement value, but also in terms of marriage. And that the families that were being formed were not informed Jewishly. They were not passing it on. They were not plugged in at all. And it was like reached emergency levels. It's like not going to the doctor. It's like not going to the dentist for a long time. It's like, dude, 15 cavities? No. So they had emergency drilling. Okay. The emergency drilling, one of the major projects that came out of that is the Jewish community ponied up big time and Birthright was born. And I think that's the program to what you're referring. Like, yeah. All right, what do we do? Chicken the head cut off. I don't know. Sunday school hasn't worked. It's boring and no one likes it. Let's send them Israel. Okay, let's send them Israel. So, the Jews, to our credit, we put our money where our mouth is, and hundreds of millions of dollars were raised. And to our credit, to say, look, we value our people, we value our identity. So any Jewish kid, originally it was from 18 to 22, now it's 18 to 32, who wants a free 10-day trip to Israel, they got. So that's a little bit about that trip.
What is your impression of the Jewish identity, the way that the Jewish community is portrayed in the media.
Yeah.
I understand how complicated that can be. So as someone who is so a part of the community, what is it like and what are you seeing and what are your impressions of how others are portraying you?
Yeah. So Keith, how many hours is the podcast?
Right.
What I will say does not preclude the fact that other groups are also not treated fairly as well. But in terms, I think what has happened, and this is way before the students who are listening to this, in 1967, Israel was 19 years old as a country. It was founded there are many, many Holocaust survivors. And I know we'll get to the Holocaust maybe a little later, but Israel was the darling of the world. Israel was the great underdog. It was attacked by five major nations, which totally outnumbered them in people and weaponry in every possible way. And in 6 days, this total underdog defended itself and gained vast amounts of territory. And Israel in June 1967 was the darling of the world. And since that date, it has been a steady decline in terms of how Israel is perceived in the world. Mm-hmm. And much of the answer to your question, unfortunately, how does the world view my culture has become a flashpoint on how the world views Israel. And there's an issue. There is an issue. How do you make peace with people who don't want to compromise? And that doesn't mean everyone, but it means that Israel is not going to apologize for being there. And the flashpoint of how Israel is perceived is based at how the Jewish people, I think, are perceived is through this conflict. And so every time there's a flare up in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, then the news are you have the Palestinians throwing rocks and the Israelis with their machine guns, and Israel's dead. There's no way that Israel can win that PR war. All perception, I believe, of every Jew is wrapped up in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which is very complicated, and there are good people on both sides of it. And so therefore, there are many, many, many Jewish students on campuses, and I used to be the rabbi at UCLA, who feel intimidated to speak up to be Jewish, speak up to be proud to support Israel. And I'll tell you one example. I know you want to ask follow-up, but I'll be real with you. One of the scariest moments of my life was in UCLA. This was back in 2006 on Israel Independence Day. Jews were having a celebration in the middle of the plaza, and we were surrounded by Palestinian students with plastic machine guns that looked very real, with posters of dead babies and being shouted down. I'm telling you, I was married, many children. I feel very secure in who I am. Keith, it was one of the scariest moments of my life. And I'm thinking to myself, that type of intimidation, I have no problem, free speech, no problem. You're gonna bring guns or what look like gun, you bring forces of intimidation. So I'm all for a good debate. We Jews always debate, but it has to be done in a way that is positive, that each side is heard. And I think some of the tactics today on campus are unfortunately exploitative of this political situation to make, unfortunately, the outcome is that many Jews don't feel comfortable on campus. And that, unfortunately, is the reality for a lot of Jews on various campuses throughout America.
How do you find the way, where and how do you manage or navigate living, existing with someone who doesn't want to live and exist with you?
You know, if I had the answer, maybe we could share a Nobel Prize, Keith. Ladies and gentlemen, it's the Keith and Rabbi Shalom Nobel Prize, right. 2023.
Let's do it, man. Let's do it.
We got it. It starts all here at NLU. We're going to get it.
Right. Okay.
Torah and Judaism always starts with individual personal relationships.
And for those of you who are not familiar with the Torah, because I know Torah is for those who are Christian, it's equivalent to the Bible. And that's not even quite fair because the Bible is kind of inside of the Torah and, yeah. and, but we won't go there, but yeah.
Okay. Right. So, yeah. So the Jewish Bible, we say the Jewish Bible in Hebrew, they call it the Tanakh, which basically there's three major sections. The, if you ever been to a bar mitzvah and you see the scroll that they're rolling out, he did such a good job reading it. Oh, Joshua, such a good job. Anyway, the scroll that they're reading from is the five books of Moses. Okay. That's the T. Then there's Nevi'im, the prophets. Okay, like Isaiah or Jeremiah. And then the Ketuvim, the writings are Psalms or Proverbs, the scrolls of Ruth and Esther, etc. So the T, N, and K together are called Tanakh. That's what we call our Jewish Bible. And so when I mentioned the Torah, that's basically our instruction book of how to live. And now after that explanation, I totally forgot what I'm supposed to say.
It's okay, because that's just, that means it's good. That means we are diving into the deep. You know what I'm saying? We are just chipping away at that iceberg that's underneath there. We're getting there, man. So it's all good.
I love it. The background to the state of Israel, not the entire background, but a major part of the background of the modern state of Israel was the Holocaust. And people throw a Holocaust term around like it's going out of style, like it's going quick. You got to use the term or else it's not really an injustice. And I think it's unfair. It's like, you know, people throw apartheid around like it's going out of style. I think that's awful because that was a specific, awful, terrible. I mean, Jim Crow laws were nothing compared to what apartheid was. So when you throw the apartheid label around, that's awful. And I mourn with South Africans when they use apartheid. I mean, certainly describe Israel, which is just factually not true. But every situation they use it and it cheapens the term. So the Holocaust, why it was unique in Jewish history is because in I believe also world history, it was a entire plan, a thought out plan designed and implemented by one nation to wipe out an entire nation, man, woman, and child, beyond its own borders. This is not country X kicking out minority population Y. This was country X saying there, and you can look it up, and I encourage your students to look up the Wannsee Conference. The Wannsee Conference was in 1942, the beginning of January 1942. This is when all the head Nazis got together and they say, let's make a plan. Now, if anything, you give credit to the Germans, they're very well organized. Listen, we Jews get through history by having a little bit of a dark sense of humor. You know, yes. You can't laugh at it. And they had a plan. And you see it. You go to the Holocaust museums, you see they had a number on each country, how many Jews. And even in one country, Albania, it's a tiny country in Europe, 200 Jews. So there were 3 million and whatever in Poland. But 200 in Albania? What do they care about 200 Jews in Albania for? No, because that was their mission. So what was unique was that we were subject to a plan of genocide, man, woman, and child. This was not a territorial dispute. This was even some of the German generals when they were losing the war in Russia against the Soviet Union, like, Hitler, stop using the trains for the Jews we needed for supplies. And he didn't, because he had this vision. So coming from the ashes of the Holocaust, there was really two approaches how to rebuild the Jewish community. One was, that was then, this is now. We're going to bury the past and we're going to move forward. So you saw in America a tremendous success of the secular Jew, of we're going to take all of that energy, we're going to forget about it, we're going to make it. Mm-hmm. And in many, many, many ways, the Jewish people made it in America. They made it financially, they made it in success in professions. There was a tremendous focus on education. Tremendous focus on it. They saw education and hard work were the keys. And in America, they were right. And I think now, getting back to answer your question, in the current climate, Jews are considered privileged. We are white predominantly, although there is a robust India, Jewish community. If you go to Israel, it's like you think you're in downtown Manhattan. You know, it's like all sorts of different color shades, and most of them are Jewish. I mean, we're really from Ethiopia, Ethiopian community. But predominantly in America, let's face it, okay? Except when our beards are big and bushy, okay? We're white. That we're white predominantly. Sephardic Jews might have a little darker color. And I think now the tension that many Jews feel is that we're the privileged class. And by definition, we become the bad guy before we start.
Hey guys, Keith here. Just wanted to let you know that if you are interested in learning more about Jewish Heritage Month, please go to Eagle Life and search Jewish Heritage Month, and all of the activities from this month's events will be there. In particular, if you would like to get a copy of Elie Wiesel, noted author Elie Wiesel's book Night, or his book Day, please stop by the Student Engagement Office for your free copy. And also, on Sunday, May 29th, we are visiting the Jewish Holocaust Museum. And guess what? Tickets are free. Just go to the Student Engagement Office on your campus. My conversation with Rabbi Garfinkel continues.
No one ever gave us a cent. We have earned everything. And I think in the current climate, it's very easy to cancel people, especially people who are successful financially. And let's face it, I wish I was a millionaire. I'm not far from it. But classically, the Jews have done very well in America in relative freedom of expression and freedom of mobility, et cetera, and a focus on education and hard work. And I think the tension now is the Jew is looked at someone as the enemy in a certain way by society. You're the privileged one keeping down the minorities. And I'm not going to defend every Jew. It's not my job and not my, but I think if you're asking in general trends where the point of conflict is, the Jews who pulled ourselves up by our bootstraps have succeeded in America, now feel that we have a target on our back. But wasn't that the promise of America? Wasn't that the great promise that if you work hard and you focus on education and you focus on responsibility, the classic Judeo-Christian lessons, isn't that what America was about? And now we turn around, it's like, we're the bad guy? What do we do? So there's your controversial answer, Keith.
Switching gears just a little bit.
Yeah, please.
For some reason, Hanukkah has seemed to... For non-Jews, Hanukkah is like, I think it's like the most important thing. But when you talk to someone who's Jewish, they're kind of like, I mean, maybe I'll do something, and then you, when you dig deeper into it, you really realize that it's a lot of it has to do with this, the importance, the significance that non-Jewish people put on Christmas, and therefore they're looking around for equivalents or parallels and stuff. I just always wanted to get like, what's your impression on that? Is it just kind of ridiculous?
Keith, I tell you, my favorite song during the holiday season. Tis the season to do Hanukkah, la, 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 la.
I thought you were going to say that Mariah Carey song. Oh God.
No. I can't hit those notes, Keith. You really touched on a great point. Ladies and gentlemen, top 10 Jewish holidays. You know, where are they going? Like Hanukkah. Wasn't there some Passover thing? What about that Day of Judgment? Wasn't that in there somewhere? So I'll tell you the irony, so I'm going to see you and I'll raise you. How am I going to do that? Is because the irony is, I mean, you're so correct that Hanukkah became, and now we obviously love Hanukkah. It's not a biblical holiday. It happened later in history after the Bible was sealed. And so we call it one of the rabbinic holidays. And it's still valued and precious and beautiful and wonderful, but it doesn't have the force or the restrictions, I would say, the restrictions of a biblical holiday. On a biblical holiday like a Sabbath, we don't drive. We don't plow our fields, you know, we don't mow our lawns, we don't do many activities to make it a holy day. Hanukkah, you mow your lawn all you want. It's the middle of winter, no, not a lawn to mow. But it's different in that sense. So what happened in Hanukkah? Hanukkah was the time that there's a general rule of how Jews interact with their culture around them. If it is an attractive culture, then Jews tend to assimilate. If it's not such an attractive culture, they don't tend to assimilate. In other words, no offense if there's any Babylonians out there, okay? But when the first temple was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar, who is in Babylon, we went and he took, you know, ancient civilization 101, me stronger than you, me beat you up, me take you back to my country and serve me slaves. Okay, so that was basically Jew world history, you know. So King Nebuchadnezzar was the king of Babylon and beat us up and took us back. And the Babylonian culture was not so attractive. There was not a lot of assimilation going on in of the Jews with the Babylonians. However, when Greece came along, they got those cool togas, they got Olympics, they got architecture, they got philosophy, they have good food. I don't know, that feta cheese, there was something about it that, you know, it spoke their language. And, you know, feed a Jew a Greek salad and that's it. They want to become Greek. And there was a major part of the Jewish community that totally assimilated into Greek culture. And to show you how assimilated they were, they actually fought with the Greeks during the battle. They left their people and they fought with the Greeks against the Jews. So the great holiday of Hanukkah was when the Jews said, this is enough. And we're not going to assimilate. We're going to be proud of our own traditions. And we're going to throw off the yoke of the Greeks. And we're going to become identified as Jews and not as Greeks. It's the ultimate self-identity holiday. Mm-hmm. And the irony that you're pointing out is that the Hanukkah became so popular because of trying to be... to fit into the culture of the day. It's like there's no greater irony than that. Now, that said, to the Jewish people's credit in America, they could have just jettisoned it. They could have just forgot about it and just started serving, you know, doing Christmas. So on a certain level, it's a sign that they're still maintaining their tradition. But there's no question that Hanukkah became super more popular, certainly eyes of Jews in America and non-Jews, because of this phenomenon of we want our Christmas.
For those who don't know, briefly share with us Shabbat.
Okay, I want everyone to know, everyone needs Shabbat. Shabbat is a time where we check out to as much as possible, check out from this world, and we live a heavenly existence for 25 hours, because we add a little bit before sundown, a little bit after three stars are out Saturday night. Friday, that's a little before sundown, Jewish women light candles. Saturday night, we have a ceremony that takes the Sabbath out, and those 25 hours, we don't drive, turn off our cell phones, we focus on the relationships that are most important. You go to the airport, you go to a restaurant. When do parents and children speak to each other? You know, our conversations have devolved into cavemanic monosyllabic grunts. Oh, Johnny, how are you doing today? What? No. Can you verbal? It's like, I'm playing Candy Crush, Mom. There's too much going on. I got the watermelon. It is such a gift, a divine gift. The Talmud, one of our major books of Jewish learning, talks about God in his precious storehouse, gave the Jewish people this gift of a Sabbath. And it's a day of detaching from the physical world, although very much in the physical world of beautiful family meals together. It's a time where we invite dozens of our students over to our home, and families multi-generational, we'll get together. It's like Thanksgiving every week, okay? So when America goes crazy, like, wow, we had 15 people at our table. I'm like, only 15? I do that every week. I got 20, 30, 40. So, you know, but the point is, how much would the world benefit from turning our cell phones and computers off for 25 hours? In fact, Keith, the rabbi is going to throw down a challenge to the NLU community. You ready? See if you, Friday night, if you can go 1 hour without using your cell phone or computer. If people want to improve their relationships, you want to improve your marriage or your friendships, take a day to Sabbath. And there is actually a movement among the culture to take a day to Sabbath. That's one of the tremendous benefits of what Shabbos is. Shabbat is.
So you guys heard it here. Rabbi Garfinkel put out a challenge to you, and we're going to make this official. The week that this episode airs, that Friday, we're challenging every NLU student to go 1 hour. No cell phone, no electronic equipment, no computer, and you are just engaging your loved ones, your family, and your friends. 1 hour. And then when you come back to class on that Monday, we want you to tell us about it. Tell us what that was like, just to go for 1 hour on a Friday.
Well, you know it's going to be. If your students take the rabbi up on it, it means that they're all going to have to prearrange a place where they're just going to have to chill out together. Because you can't text right now. So it's got to be arranged in advance. We're hanging out at Joe's or Cindy's place or whatever it is. And we're just going to chill. And if it's, you know, the students are at home with their parents. If there is one thing that I could recommend that would be an exponential bump up in every relationship that you have on planet Earth, relationship with yourself, with others, and with God, is that 1 hour, take a day to Sabbath and be with the people that you love. And it just makes so much sense. And so when I have my Jewish students like, Rabbi, it's so weird. So I'm like, you don't get it. This is the best thing in the world. 25 hours on your cell phone. Oh.
I now have to ask you, like, what is one of the best things about being a part of the Jewish community?
Keith, I'm so glad that you asked that. I want you to know, being part of the Jewish people, I consider one of the greatest privileges of my life. Knowing that there is a community of people who have your back no matter what. I'm going to give you a very modern example that I think will speak to you. You know, we're the world community is reeling right now from the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And a very sad situation. A lot of lives have been lost. There are anywhere from 100 to 200,000 Jews in Ukraine, or at least before the invasion. On a dime, the Jewish community around the world has raised at least $100 million, all the different organizations, if not more, to save and evacuate and feed and shelter their brethren that they've never met, don't know what they look like, and never will ever meet them. I know, and I'm just being honest with you, I have a neighbor of mine who does very well, wrote a $100,000 check. Because if you're Jewish, we're family. Now, we're family with all nations of the world. We're all related. But it starts at home, and then it goes out in concentric circles. If there's a Jew in trouble, the Jewish community's got your back. The amount of organizations that are in my community, in the what we call the West Rogers Park, Lincoln Woods, Skokie, Peterson Park, you know, the 94 and Tui, when you drive by, it's like, hey, what's down Tui? You got the shtetl, you got the old worlds going over there, right?
I drive up and down there every twice a day.
There you go.
Get to back and forth to work. So
whenever you see Tui, Key, we got to grab coffee. So, okay, but whenever you come down Tui, couple miles, you're right in the heart of the Bible Belt, okay? The Torah Belt, okay? And the amount of organizations that are there to help people struggling with bills, electric bills, food pantries, you name it, any type of financial services. Let me just give you an example. There is a, there's an organization that many of them that actually think about what possible needs there are. There are free loan societies, not just with money. But imagine, Keith, you know, we have, we focus on, you know, larger families. My wife and I, thank God, are blessed with 8 children, 7 girls, 1 boy. We're actually planning a wedding coming up at the end of June. It's so exciting. Do you know how much wedding dresses are, Keith? Do you have any idea how much you think a rabbi's salary is going to cover wedding dresses for 6 sisters and the mom is a 7 dress and the bride? There are, that's a fortune. That's thousands. There are free loan societies for wedding dresses. And wow, all you pay is the dry clean, the alterations, the dry clean. And it's remarkable. You went from a $10,000 bill to a, I don't know, whatever it's going to be. But the point is, every facet of Jewish life, there, we take care of each other. And I'm going to bust out some Hebrew on you, Keith, but I promise I'm going to translate, okay? There's this very famous statement that Jewish people live by. Kol Yisrael arevim ze bezeh. Every Jew is responsible for each other. So it's not just a nice thing we can volunteer. No, you sign as a guarantor on a loan for someone. That's the relationship that every Jew has with every other Jew. It's very, very powerful. And it's something for which we're very proud as a community. Now, from the outside, it could seem that we're insular and that we only care about ourselves. I will say, per capita and even in objective dollars, the Jewish people have been and are very generous, even to non-Jewish causes. The major, and this is an incredible stat, the mega donors, which is 7 digits and more, to non-Jewish institutions, hospitals, operas, you name it, civic organizations, most of them are Jews. And so even though we might be perceived as being insular, I think we have done classically a good job of not only taking care of our own, but sharing the bounty and the blessing that America has given us. But in terms of the best part about being Jewish, that really is something very special. You know that whenever you're in trouble, last thing I'll tell you about this, there's 2 other organizations. One is called Hatzalah, which is a volunteer ambulance organization. They have walkie-talkies and literally a response time anywhere in our community. If anyone has a medical emergency, it's less than 2 minutes. It's almost under a minute. So as I said, on Sabbath, we don't use our phones, but you know, there's certain guys who have like the CIA, you know, earpiece in there, walking up. They're using them on Sabbath because saving a life overrides the laws of Sabbath. And in a second, with under a minute, 60 seconds, the volunteers get save people. And my favorite volunteer organization is called Haverim, which is in the winter when you're stuck in the alley with snow in the snow. You call up and they're, again, volunteers who come and get you out of the snow. They bring a spare tire. And there's no aspect of life that the Jewish people don't think about to be able to help other people.
How can someone from the outside of the Jewish community support you?
When you hear something negative about Jews or Israel, classic example, the tragic death of this Palestinian, the reporter in Israel, and there's riots in Israel now. Before you believe, hook, line, and sinker, what you're hearing on the news, maybe just stop a second and pretend that you're back in high school on the debate team. And you got the card of the position that you did not want to defend, but you had to defend it anyway. And I think this is a healthy exercise, and I encourage my students to do this all the time, is if you do not understand the other side of the debate, then you don't understand the debate. And so therefore, the first thing I would say is just reserve judgment. Do a little more research. Maybe there's another angle that I'm missing. That would be the first thing. Because usually the first angle you're going to see about Jews in Israel today is not a positive one, unfortunately. The second thing I would say, if you want to support a Jewish people, go to Israel. Just go. Take a trip. You're going to Europe. It's a quick 4-hour trip. You're in London. Say, hey, you know what? What am I doing the next few days? Let me just bounce to Israel for a few days. Okay. Even better, take a pilgrimage to Israel. I guarantee you, your life will be changed. Your perspective will be changed. Certainly, if you're a Christian on any level, to appreciate what Christianity is, to walk in the steps of your tradition there, it's truly, truly remarkable. And I think when you'll get back, you will have a much broader perspective. Thus, I'd say really would be the two main things. Reserve judgment and, hey, tickets are cheap. Let's go. Get yourself to the Holy Land.
Some friends of mine, my good friend Matthew Charney and Rabbi Elliot Gertel, who was in the Hyde Park community for a very long time, taught me that the Jewish community. There they are.
Hold on, Keith. I have to tell you. Don't forget your question.
No, I got
Hold
it.
Hold on, one second. we gotta get this. I got it. Okay, now hold on. Aria, watch out. Come here. Awesome. You're on with Keith. So, Keith, you know how you have these chairs, these office chairs, and this is Batsheva.
Hi.
You know you have the little lever that when you're sitting down, and if you're sitting and they pull the lever, you drop down? Batsheva, what did you just do to your eye?
That was you did.
Give me a kiss. All right, let us go.
That's awesome. She's awesome.
So I am sorry to interrupt the podcast, but that is what happens whenever she gets a chance at a very important dramatic moment of a class I'm giving on Zoom. All this stuff, I'll go, choo-choo.
All of that is going in the podcast. I promise you, all of this will be in there. I learned from these friends of mine that the Jewish community, you have a prayer for almost everything.
Yes.
Like for everything. So this is NLU. What can you offer to us as we're about to sign off? Right. Share a prayer with us.
Well, Keith, ask a rabbi an open-ended question for one prayer, you're going to get two. Okay. You know, as we say, you know, we love the schmooze, you know, we love the schmooze. You know, one of the proud distinctions of the Jewish people is we've added schmooze, which is like talking, right? You know, to the American English dictionary. I want to share with you two. There's a beautiful prayer that the Jews say Saturday morning when we're all together, the whole community in the synagogue. We pray for the welfare of the state, of the government leaders. Why? Because we believe that we work as much as possible within the system to improve it. We're not people who want to tear things down. We want to grow where we're rooted. And even if we disagree with the policies of the government, the greatest aspect of America is that we can work for change. And that prayer validates that we pray that God give them wisdom and that we work with them to create a more just society. So that's the first one. I think that's hopefully resonates with everyone. And now that's maybe on the national level. I want to tell you about a prayer that if it was not in the prayer book, this is like mind-blowing emoji. Okay, so let me paint the picture for you, Keith. You're at O'Hare Airport, and nature calls, okay? Happens to the best of us,
yep.
And one has to relieve oneself. And if you notice an Orthodox Jew, an observant Orthodox Jew coming out of the bathroom, will be mumbling. If you look at their mouths, and sometimes they'll even stand in place. And what are they doing? And the answer is, there is a prayer for having successfully gone to the bathroom. mind-blowing emoji. Now, why? Because high school biology, there are, without exaggeration, on the cellular to the macro level, trillions of things that went into the successful process of eating and digestion and expulsion, okay? And to recognize, and this is where I think Judaism shines, is that God is not in the ivory tower of life. He's in every detail. And the fact that there's peristalsis and that my body is just on autopilot, quote unquote, is a divine gift. And if we had to give instructions for how to digest this food, it would be like, we wouldn't even know what to say. Oh my gosh, I have to cram my AP biology. What? Oh, okay. This enzyme here and that, colon has to do that. We'd have no idea even how to write the instruction book. And it happens with regularity. And the rabbis recognize that this is a miraculous process. The miracles aren't just the splitting of the sea. The miracles are the everyday gifts that we benefit from. And so therefore there is a blessing for successfully going to the bathroom. And now you NLU students will know when you see the Jews with their yarmulkes, right? Or the Orthodox ladies with their skirts and they're mumbling outside the bathroom at O'Hare Airport, you will know that they are thanking the Almighty for the miracles, for the everyday miracles that he showers upon.
Thank you for being with us, and I'm glad that you helped us to acknowledge and celebrate for the very first time at National Lewis University Jewish American Heritage Month. What an awesome way to do it. So thank you, Rabbi Gerfinko.
Thank you, Keith. Anytime you want, I would be delighted to come back and if people do want to know more about Judaism, there's a lot of resources online. I'm plugging a 20-minute podcast each week, a little snippet of Jewish wisdom called Monday Motivation with Rabbi Gerfinko. If anyone would like to listen, that is certainly wonderful. But I really, Keith, thank you for the leadership you're taking, and may God bless you and your efforts to increase the understanding among the communities. And that's really when the ultimate peace is going to come, is that respect and tolerance. So keep up the good work, and I'm truly, truly honored to be here.
If you have a topic for Discover You you'd like to hear, please contact Student Engagement at nl.edu.